I mean, you don't need the language excuse to do that. Like, you can spit in someone's face if you want to.
Welcome to Keep It Fictional, a weekly podcast for book lovers by book lovers. Build your to-be-read list with Sadie, Liz, Virginia, Fiona, and Corrine from the Port Moody Public Library. Warning, this podcast contains strong opinions and may cause an increase in your library holds list.
Gogi Wadyongo said, "Through the act of translation, we break out of linguistic confinement and reach many other communities. Let all languages be, but they can meet through translation." And that's why I describe translation as the language of languages. September is National Translation Month, and of course, in August, we celebrated Women in Translation Month. And translators are often the unsung heroes. And sometimes on books, I find you can't even find their name on the cover, which is ridiculous because translators play such an important role in making that book accessible to readers. And they are doing this all over the world for readers of all kinds of languages. And without them, we would never have the opportunity to experience a world of literature. So it baffles me that they go unacknowledged so frequently, but not on Keep It Fictional today. We are going to celebrate the work of translators. Each of us has brought a work of translation today. So I'm looking forward to this tour of literature around the world from all my book friends today. And we have Elle, we have Corrine, and Sadie with us today. So why don't we start our book tour with Elle?
All right. So I have brought The Plotters by Eunsoo Kim, translated by Sora Kim Russell. The Plotters is a Korean thriller following an assassin named Rasaeng. Rasaeng was born in a trash can and raised in the Doghouse Library, a place where hitmen are hired by the plotters, the people who call the shots and make the plans that change the direction of the country. Old Raccoon is the head of the library and Rasaeng's cranky father figure, but he is in danger of being usurped by another son of the library, Hanja, a slick character who is out to modernize the assassination business. When Rasaeng goes out on a job to kill an old man who was once a high-ranking military officer, he goes off script. He ends up invited into the old man's home and shares a drink and a meal with him, getting to know him and his friendly dog a little better. It's only after this that Rasaeng feels the time is right to kill the old man. But instead of handing over the body like he's supposed to, he has him cremated. This small decision kicks off a domino effect, changing the way that the assassination was supposed to affect the country, but also changing Rasaeng's perspective on his job and his position in the world. The position of the doghouse is changing, and while Hanja has become the leader of one of the top assassination groups in the country, Old Raccoon still represents tradition, and many of the most lucrative contracts still go through him. As a war between Hanja and Old Raccoon approaches, Rasaeng has to figure out where he stands. Will he stick with Old Raccoon, who raised him yet seems stuck in the past, or embrace the new capitalist ambition of Hanja? At the same time, the unknown world of the plotters begins to encroach on Rasaeng's life, giving him yet another problem to deal with, which he discovers while on a week-long bender, his post-kill tradition, in the form of an explosive hidden in his toilet, which a friend tells him later would have blown his butt clean off. Investigating this explosive leads him to a mysterious woman who may be more than she seems on first glance and kicks off the book's spiral towards an explosive end. I haven't read a huge number of Korean novels in translation. The main ones I've read so far have been unsettling short novels like The Vegetarian by Han Kang or The Hole by Hye Young Pyun. So this was a different perspective on Korean culture for me. I enjoyed it a lot, especially the dry sense of humor that Eunsoo Kim displays in his writing and the ways in which it subverts the traditional thriller genre. Rasaeng is a thoughtful protagonist, very aware of his position in a changing world, and constantly wondering where he will fit as the world moves on. As a hitman, the fact that his conscience is what drives him for much of the novel is an interesting choice, and one that brings him closer to the reader, in my opinion. This book is an interesting take on the thriller. It's highly philosophical, which one might not expect from something in this genre. But also the writing is very strongly visual, with parts of the novel almost feeling like a movie as you read it. There's a lot of animal metaphors in this book, with several characters named after animals, including the aforementioned old raccoon and a crematist named Bear. Dogs especially are important in the book, and specifically the idea of wolves becoming domesticated into dogs. I found the book started off strong, with the chapter where Rasang meets the old military officer hooking me, but there were bits in the sort of very beginning where it dragged a bit before revving up towards the ending. There's a lot of action in the back half of the book, eschewing the ubiquitous gun violence found in many American crime novels for knives, which was a cool choice and one that I think changes the character of the violence to feel more personal. Anyone who's a fan of Korean crime cinema or who wants a somewhat more thoughtful thriller would be well suited to picking up The Plotters by Eun-Soo Kim, translated by Sora Kim Russell.
Thank you, Al. Forgot about that book. It's quite a long time ago. It was great. It was a fun one. And it's like you said, it's an interesting kind of like almost like a literary thriller in some ways. And it makes it fun to when people do something different with the genre. So that's great. Thank you so much. One of the things we try to do today is to pick books from different countries and different languages. And so since Al took Korean, I wonder what Korean is going to do today.
Yes, I was devastated when I looked at that spreadsheet and I was like, ah! But at least you did highlight one of my favorite translators, Sora Kim Russell, who translates a lot of Hwang Suk-young's book, like Familiar Things and At Dusk. So I was really glad to see her name on the list of translators that we'd be talking today. And tragically, today I cannot talk about my man, Antoine Herr, and all of his amazing translations. So I had to look elsewhere. But this is an author that I actually did see pop up on Antoine Herr's Twitter quite a bit because her new book is out and it's sitting on my bookshelf and I was maybe going to choose it for this podcast, but it is like 800 pages long. And due to my technique of reading the book the night before, I did not think that I would be able to be here and talk about it in a coherent fashion. So I actually went with her earlier, much shorter work, which I'm very interested to see how she does long form. So Kazu's family has always been unlucky. As he sits listening to the recitation of his ancestors' stories, who were persecuted and driven from their home and ill-fated, as he sits and listens to the story of the hardship of his ancestors, told by his father, at his only son's funeral, he begins to understand that his luck has been made in the stars. After years of working his finger to the bone in backbreaking manual labor, he was driven by the idea that if he worked hard enough, he could pay for his son's education, and his son could finally be the first one to raise the entire family out of the grinding poverty that they have always found themselves in. And for a while, it seemed like their fate would be changed. His son was born on the same day that the emperor's son was born. Although their circumstances couldn't be more different, the emperor's son was born to a radio announcement and joy of the entire country, while Kazu's son, his birth was difficult as he raced down the streets to get the midwife to help his poor, suffering wife, even though he knew he could not pay her. And after working all of these years, after never seeing his son, never taking him to the zoo, never taking him for his first drink, never really having a conversation with this son, all of his dreams are realized when his son at 21 years old passes his radiology exam. And he is destined for a new and better life. Until, again, far away from his family working in Tokyo, Kazu gets a call that his son has suddenly, inexplicably died. And so he returns back to his home, one of the handfuls of times that he has been there, to lay his son to rest. Kazu has always been unlucky, on the fringes of history and society. He was born during World War II, but was not old enough to go and serve, but felt the impacts his entire life. His family were poor, rice pickers, kelp gatherers, but they never seem to have enough money. He wanders from labor job to labor job, eventually going down to Tokyo to be a part of the building projects for the Olympic stations. Again, on the fringes of it, not involved in it, but using his own hands to dig through the dirt because they did not have machines to do it. His life has always been tied to the life of the emperor, even though they couldn't be more different. His life has intersected with him, and so has his death. Indeed, as we start the novel, Kazu is dead. He has haunting the Ueno Station Park, one of the main beautiful attractions in Tokyo, pleasing to the eye, surrounded by glittering museums and galleries. But it is also the home of Tokyo's homeless population. And this is where Kazu has found himself. After tragedy in his life, he finds himself among those who have nothing. And even after death, he cannot escape this. This book is about a man and about outsiders who are kind of living on the fringes of society, buffeted by bigger things they cannot control. There are the small personal disasters that Kazu experiences, as well as the natural disasters, earthquakes, tsunamis, and the man-made disasters, the firebombing of Tokyo by the Americans. How all of these things affect the most vulnerable people. This book is about the life, death, and afterlife of Kazu, who continues to be unlucky. He is stuck in this park watching all of the rich people go by and the lives of those that he lived with go by. This is the National Book Award winner for Book in Translation, Tokyo Ueno Station by Yu Miri. And what I think this book does really well is, as she kind of says in an interview with the New York Times, Japan likes to present itself as being very clean. But how you achieve that is often by pushing those that are deemed unworthy by society out of that picture. And in fact, the homeless people in Ueno Park are constantly displaced by the emperor's family coming to visit anytime they want to go to a museum, anytime they want to go to a gallery. The riot police come, make them pick up all of their belongings, their tents, their homes, their pets, and leave for somewhere else. They don't care where, they just can't be there. I think that this book is such an interesting and empathetic way of looking at people experiencing homelessness. In fact, the author based this on a lot of interviews that she did with people living in Ueno Park. There are some really beautiful and heartbreaking things. In one part of the book, Kazu says, before we had families, we had houses. Nobody starts off life in a hovel made of cardboard and tarps, and nobody becomes homeless because they want to be. I think that she brings such a level of empathy and humanity to these people that are often invisible in society. She has said that this comes from her own position as an outsider in Japanese culture. So she is Sainichi Korean. So after the Korean War, her mother immigrated over to Japan. And although Yu Miri has been born and speaks Japanese as her native language, she is still a Korean citizen. She will never be a Japanese citizen. And so that feeling of being on the outside, she has a story where she was a very quiet and shy child. Her life was very difficult because of these structures put in place to not allow her and her family to be fully integrated into the Japanese society. That she was in a class and her teacher looked at her and said, well, can you even speak Japanese? Even though she was born there, even though that is the only language she knows. And so she has said that when I was a child, I didn't belong anywhere. So I feel like that's what I'm writing about when I write about the homeless people or people on the edge of society. She describes herself as a parabola antenna. so that I can magnify the voices of people who aren't often heard. This small, very slim, easily readable volume is, okay, I should say easy in some way, not very easy. Has been translated by the Japanese by Morgan Giles. And Morgan Giles was very struck by this novel in that, again, it's examining a part of society and of voices that aren't always necessarily heard. And what I didn't know until, again, I listened to Anton Hur's Twitter, is that often translators are the ones that are pitching these books to publishing houses. It's not always necessarily publishing houses that know that these books are great and then commission them to be translators. It's the translators actually doing the legwork. They are the ones reading these books and saying, actually, you know, I would like to pitch this project to you to do this in translation. And so Morgan Giles was really drawn by the theme of this book, in that it was examining that society that has never really been represented before, as well as Yu Miri is a very poetic writer. If you're looking for a lot of plot in this book, you're not necessarily going to get it. You're going to have to really squint pretty hard to figure out what's going on. It took me quite a few pages to realize that he was dead. So that was interesting. It's, again, not so much a narrative. It's more like a really long tone poem. So if you feel like you want to hearken back to Longfellow or Tennyson, and you're like, poems should be longer. Poems should just be so much longer, then you're really going to enjoy this. If you like narrative and plot and characters and things that lead to A to B, oh boy, is this not for you. Oh boy. Because you're not going to get a linear narrative. It's more like a little squiggly line that also goes into a circle. And then there's the sadness wave. But then hope. And then that hope is going to get crushed. But it is, as a person who doesn't mind a tone poem, I really liked it. I think that if you really enjoyed George Saunders' Lincoln in the Bardo, if you kind of enjoyed that kind of weird, I'm a ghost drifting around, listening to other people's conversations, and then also telling you a little bit about my history and giving you the history of Tokyo, but also there's these ladies who are just talking about lunch and their crummy husbands. This is absolutely going to be for you. If you like eavesdropping with a little bit of social history, then this is also going to be for you. But if you want the book that is described by the back end for the dust jacket, it's not going to be that. It's not just going to be that. Just accept that this is a very long, beautiful tone poem and just let it wash over you. Let it wash over you like a wave, and you will really, really enjoy it. So I'm very thankful to Yu Miri for this very beautiful, poetic look at kind of the fringes of society, and also to Morgan Giles for kind of bringing this to English speaking audiences. So yeah, tone poems, people, tone poems.
Thank you, Miss Corinne, for bringing us a book that maybe give a different perspective. I think you're totally right. As an outsider who don't live in Japan, you don't often hear and see that side of Japan, which obviously exists, but it's just not something that is obvious to us, because it's not, like you said, advertised. Thank you for that. So why don't we go to our existential question for today? Since we're talking about languages, I would love to know from my book friends, what made-up language would you like to learn?
This is a made-up language, so I'm sticking within the criteria, but it's also real. I think Esperanto is hilarious. There's just something about the beautiful naivety of someone who's well, it's very easy. I'll just make a language that everyone can understand. Oh my dude. It's a beautiful humanitarian idea that as soon as you think about it critically for 2 seconds, you're like, oh, no. But I would honestly like to learn it, because it is such an interesting thought experiment that he clearly thought would work and would never work, because within language is built in your entire worldview, whether you realize it or not. And as soon as you kind of buff it up against another language that you're learning, you're like, oh no, it's not just words. It's how you think and it's how you perceive the entire world. And so in that way, like, Esperanto is doomed to failure because you can't do that, friend. But I would love to learn it because it makes me laugh every time.
Pretty sure I have borrowed a book from the library way, way, way back on it. Just be like, what is this?
Yeah.
It's fascinating for sure.
Yeah.
For me, I mean, this would not be a surprise, I think. And I actually have a conversational language course that I bought for this. And it belongs to the Living Language series, which is a real series that publish language courses for languages around the world. And I have got one at home, which I wish I had it with me, which is on Living Language Dothraki. I didn't actually listen to it that much, but I'm like, I would love to try to learn Dothraki. And if that is not something that you would like, you know, on Duolingo, that you can also learn High Valyrian, I believe it is. So that's also available. So yeah, I think Dothraki would be something. One day I'm going to pick that Living Language, get those CDs out. And I don't know, I don't have a CD player, but like, find a way to like listen to that, I think, and learn that language.
Come to the library and use one of the computers.
Yeah, no thanks.
See, I was also going to say Dothraki. Mm-hmm. And mine was split between Dothraki and Tolkien's Elvish, just because it's so prolific and gigantic and you would never be able to learn all of it ever. And I don't know why that's appealing to me, but for some reason it is. So yeah, just one of the various parts of Tolkien's Elvish.
Yeah, which dialect of Elvish would you like to learn? We've got Sindarin, we've got suddenly I can't remember the others. I used to have a book on, I called A Gateway to Sindarin, and it was actually like a grammar of Sindarin. So yeah, with the Tolkien tattoo that I have, you would think that it would be Elvish, but actually the language that popped into my mind first was the Beltir cant from The Expanse. The Expanse is a sci-fi series. And there is a group of people who live out in the belt or the Cooper Belt who do a lot of mining work and stuff for human colonies. And they've been separate from Earth for long enough that they've developed their own cant, their own sort of Creole language of a bunch of different languages. And there's a little bit of it in the books, but in the TV show, they actually had someone work on it as a conlang, and it sounds great. And I would love to learn it. I think it would be really cool.
I mean, obviously, the question is fashioned in a way that is a very nerdy question. And it's no surprise that we all have very nerdy answers for this question. Surprise Klingon didn't come up.
It's a very harsh language.
Yeah, but it's fun. It's just fun to spit at people.
I mean, you don't need the language excuse to do that. Like, you can spit in someone's face if you want to.
Very true. Anyway, I will save my spitting story for later. So I will talk about my book next. Contrary to Corinne's book, mine is a giant doorstopper. And my book today is the first book in Hindi to win the International Booker Prize. That happens in 2022, so very, very recently. And I know in past discussion, we talked about awards, and I know they don't hold a lot of weight with many of my book friends. But I think for me, if there's one award that I specifically make a point to read as many books as I can from the shortlist, it would be the International Booker Prize, and probably also the counterpart, the Booker Prize. But International Booker Prize has definitely introduced me to so many books that I would not have read and would not have heard of, and exposed me to a lot of literature from like many different countries beyond what I would say ones that I usually read. And so today's book is originally published in Hindi. It's the first one I read. This year's winner, which is Time Shelter, is written in Bulgarian. And that's, again, a corner of literature that I've never been to. But thanks to this award, I got there. So I'm basically thankful for anything that really brings more awareness to works in translation for me. So my book today is The Tome of Zen, and it's by Gitanjali Shri and translated from Hindi into English by Daisy Rockwell. And Daisy Rockwell is a translator who lives in the States, and she has done many, many works in Hindi. Ma is refusing to get out of bed. At 80 years old, shortly after her husband died, Ma has turned her back towards the door, so that when anyone enters her room, that's all they will see, her back and the lump of blanket that is Ma. She lies there, facing the wall, staring at the cracks, wondering if they are big enough for her. Would the wall be willing to absorb her? Can she just, like, get in there? Everyone tries to coax Ma out of bed. Her son, her daughter-in-law, her daughter, her grandsons, the servants. They tell her that the chrysanthemums are blooming. Ma, come see, get up. They invite her to go out for lunch. It's beautiful day. Let's have lunch outside. Join us, Ma. But Ma won't get up. Not even her favorite grandson, Sid, can get her out of bed. Sid comes barging into the room, singing out loud, playing on his air guitar, telling Granny, Granny, you naughty girl, get up, get up. But all he got was a smile from Ma. He is her favorite after all. But she won't get up. All everybody hears from Ma is the refrain of no, no, and no. But one day, a cane arrives, a gift for Ma from Sirius' son, one of Ma's grandson who lives overseas in the States. It is a collapsible cane, a cane that is decorated with butterflies, so that when you flick it open, the butterflies seem to be flying out. And while the family bickers and argues about how to get Ma out, how to get Ma up, who is responsible, blaming one another for not doing their part as son, as daughter-in-law, Ma disappeared with the cane. And when they finally found her, Ma has taken her first step of transformation. And metaphorically, because this is a Virginia book, metaphorically shed the first layer of her skin. Tome of Sand is a novel about many things. It started off sort of as a feminist tale, tackling sort of the traditional roles and expectations of women in many societies, how they are expected to provide unconditional service, how they are supposed to embrace the role of being a wife, being a mother, being a sister. And we feel this pressure in Ma, in Bahu, the daughter-in-law, and in Betty, the daughter. And what it means to get across these boundaries of gender roles. And that's what really Tome of Sand is about, is exploring how to cross these boundaries. In the case of Ma and Betty, the daughter, it's about the boundaries of family obligations. And at one point after they found Ma, she decided to move in with her daughter, Betty. Now, Betty is supposed to be the rebel in the family. She has moved out. She got married and then she got a divorce. She lived alone. Her house is full of like a random assortment of mismatched furniture and art and collectibles. Nothing makes sense in her house. And it's an affront to like her family's eyes. Like, this is not a place that they like to visit. But yet when Ma moves in, Betty is the one who starts to fret, who starts to worry, who's getting concerned when Ma starts taking risks and doing things that she feels like Ma is too old for. And she became that caretaker, while Ma is the carefree person that does whatever she wants. Betty starts to question her identity, starts to question like, well, I'm supposed to be the outcast. I'm supposed to be the progressive one. What's happening here? And it's about crossing those borders and boundaries. And as Ma would say, let's go, let's go. It also explores the idea of gender. After Ma moves in, Rosie starts showing up at Betty's house. And Rosie is a hijra, which, if you remember from one of Fiona's books, it is a term in Hindi for a transgender woman, someone who is not supposed to belong, somebody they don't consider to exist. But in the morning, when Betty wakes up, Rosie's will be there. When she goes to bed, Rosie is still there, chatting, laughing with Ma. They're organizing some community project together. And Betty can't help but feel just a little jealous and just a little inadequate. Like, what is it about me that I can't take care of Ma? Why does Ma need this other friend? And she's also very confused about Rosie, because Rosie sometimes will show up as a man. And she can't quite tell, is this Rosie? Who is this? And so trying to figure out someone who doesn't conform to those boundaries. And Rosie later on will represent a very, very important boundary that Ma will cross eventually. Tomb of Sand is one of the novels that are written about the partition in 1947. And unfortunately, a lot of these books, even though they're written in English and published in India, they're very often not available elsewhere. And so at the offer here, give a shout out to many of these novelists in one of the scenes in Tomb of Sand. And through Ma's personal journey, we get to see how traumatizing this violent event has caused among people. This border that was just imposed one August day, just like that, and how it results in millions of death and migration and of refugees, and how it continued to divide free nations until this day, and all the pain and all the suffering that this event has caused. It's interesting to read some of the reviews of this book, because maybe a little bit similar to Corinne's book, people feel like this book is too meandering. There's too many tangents and there's too many asides and too many commentaries. Sure, this is a, you know, more than 600 page. Can the story be told with fewer pages? Maybe, but will it be as much fun? I don't think so, because it's really that those asides, those like inner thoughts that really makes this book what it is and so much fun to read. You know, you get the different points of view. You got Bade, Bahu, and Betty. You got sometimes you hear from the door talking, sometimes the crows will be speaking, sometimes you got some unnamed random character that show up once and they will like tell you that, yeah, I'm just here for this one chapter, don't worry about me, I don't have a name, you know, and it's just, it's so much fun to try to see all these different elements weave in, and sometimes, yeah, they may not mean anything and sometimes they do, but it adds to the novel, it adds to the flavor. And since this is an episode about translation, I also want to kind of talk a little bit about that, because even though the author is fluent in English, she decides to write in Hindi instead. It is definitely an anti-colonist act that of hers, but also she's embracing her language. It's really amazing how much Daisy Rockwell, the translator, really captured the sounds and the rhythms in this book in that process. She talks about how she worked with Gitanjali Shree, the author, to kind of try to figure out like how best to translate this. And one of the things in the Hindi language is that it has such playfulness. And, you know, she was given the blessing to recreate this in English. So some parts of the book has, there's quite a lot of like words and passages that are kept in Hindi with a translation provided. But it also, you know, like she's also not taking everything so literally and trying to capture the spirit of the work and trying to like reproduce that essence in English. And it feels very bouncy, very playful when you read it. It's great. And it's weird to hear like the Guardian calls the translation is unnecessarily loyal, which I completely disagree with. I don't think that makes sense. It also irritates me when some of the criticisms was like, oh, well, there's so many words in Hindi. People are going to get lost, you know? And like, well, like, no, this is a book. You need to have those to give you that sense, to give you, take you to the country. And part of the joy of reading is doing the work in some ways yourself to try to understand the context, to do your research, to learn. So it's part of the fun. So yes, there will be some things that you don't get, but I'm sure, like, you know, one of the things, for example, that they complained about was that the names of the three main characters, like other than Ma, there's like Badu, Bahu, and also Betty. All three of them are basically in Hindi, they just mean son, daughter-in-law, and daughter. And they're like, well, people won't know them. People are going to miss the context. Well, I'm sure you won't complain if it is in a European language. You just expect that the reader is going to know about it. But it's like, sometimes it's a different language. So you're like complaining about it. Just, it irritates me to no end to read that, because I feel like that is, again, part of the fun of reading. Anyway, did I pick this book with Fiona in mind? Oh yeah, I did. Fiona, give you a listening. This is kind of for you. I also want to give a shout out to the narrator for the audiobook, which I listened to a little bit, Dipti Gupta. She did a really, really good job, again, capturing that language and that bounciness that I was talking about. I think it's worth listening to, it's worth reading in whatever format that you can find that fits you. So again, this is The Tomb of Sand by Gitanjali Shree and translated from Hindi into English by Daisy Rockwell. All right, we have one more book of translation to go. Sadie, where are you taking us today?
I will be taking us to Barcelona. And I'm taking us to Barcelona in 1945. So Daniel Semper was 10 years old the night that he woke up in terror, screaming with the realization that he could no longer remember his mother's face. His mother had died 6 years earlier during a cholera outbreak at the end of the Spanish Civil War. "Don't worry, Daniel," his father had said. "I'll remember for both of us." It was this night in the early summer of 1945 that Daniel's father first took him to the Cemetery of Forgotten Books. After calming Daniel's cries, his father ushers him out of the door, saying that there's something that he must show him. Now, warned never to tell anyone what he is about to see, Daniel's father leads him through the just waking streets of Barcelona until they arrive at a large door of carved wood, darkened with age. The door is opened by a small, gray-haired man who is introduced to Daniel as Isaac. Daniel and his father are brought inside into one of the most amazing sights that Daniel had ever seen. Now, Daniel has grown up around books. His father is a secondhand bookseller, and so Daniel knows books. He lives books. He breathes books. But what he sees inside this building is still more astounding than anything that he can ever describe. Towering bookshelves reach up towards the sky, seemingly defying gravity in this labyrinth of rows and aisles and galleries filled with thousands and thousands of books. "Welcome to the Cemetery of Forgotten Books," Daniel's father says. Cemetery of Forgotten Books has been around for as long as anyone living can remember, and in reality, many, many years longer than that. It is a library of sorts, but one that is only known to a very select group of people. As a bookseller, Daniel's father inherited the knowledge of the cemetery from his own father, and knowing that Daniel will one day take over the family bookshop, Daniel is now learning about it from him. The books that are found in the cemetery are not ordinary books. They are one of a kind, yes, but so much more than that. They are books that have been lost and forgotten to the rest of the world. Anytime a bookshop or a library closes, then those who know about the Cemetery of Forgotten Books will make sure that the books get there. And there, the books will wait, preserved and hidden away, until they find a new reader. As this is Daniel's first visit to this vast library, tradition dictates that he gets to pick a book, any book that he would like, and take it home with him. Once he has chosen a book, it is up to him to make sure that that book never disappears from the world. 10-year-old Daniel takes this responsibility very seriously. He takes his time exploring the galleries filled with thousands of books, running his hands over the spines, imagining the multitude of stories that are waiting within the pages. Daniel knows the book that he will pick the moment he sees it. The book is tucked into the corner of a shelf. It's bound in wine-colored leather, has gold lettering on its front cover. "The Shadow of the Wind" by Julián Carax. That night, back at home, Daniel locks himself in his room so that he can finally start his new book. Now, he's only intending to spend a few minutes on it, maybe a little bit longer, to explore the first few chapters. However, Daniel is surprised when he notices that it is already midnight and he has finished the book. He was so drawn into Carax's words and stories that he hardly noticed the passage of time. And he knows then that he must read more by this author. So the next day, Daniel approaches his father to pick his brain on the author, Julián Carax. As a secondhand bookseller, Daniel's father is very knowledgeable about many books and many authors. And so Daniel knows that he must know where Daniel can get his hands on the rest of Carax's books. However, to Daniel's surprise, his father has actually never heard of the book or the author before. Daniel's father reaches out to a wealthy and well-connected colleague of his, Gustavo Barceló, to see if he knows anything about this book or about this author. Now, Gustavo has heard of Julián Carax, but what he knows about him is even more mysterious. He tells him that no one really knows who this author is, and that his books are becoming harder and harder to find, making them very, very valuable. Whenever one of the books is discovered, for some reason, it is very quickly destroyed. Now, as a collector of rare books, Gustavo eagerly offers to buy the book from Danielle. However, knowing that it is his responsibility to make sure this book never disappears from the world, Danielle refuses to sell it to him. So throughout the following years, Danielle's focus shifts, as they would of a child who is entering adolescence and teenage years. Now, he never forgets about Carax and the mystery that surrounds him, but he also spends time with his best friend, Tomas. He gets distracted by falling in love and subsequently having his heart broken by Gustavo Barcelo's niece, Clara. And it isn't until Danielle is 16 that his mind and his life are drawn back into the mystery of Julian Carax. While out for a walk one night, Danielle is approached by a terrifying stranger who demands to know where Daniel's copy of The Shadow of the Wind is. Daniel is able to evade him and is able to hide the book back in the Cemetery of Forgotten Books. But he is now more determined than ever to learn about Carax and to figure out why some people are so intent on destroying every word that he has ever written. This begins Daniel's search through Barcelona for any clues he can find about Carax. With the help of Fermín, the bookshop's new employee, and B, Tomás's older sister, Daniel slowly starts to piece together Julian Carax's life. However, as he delves more into this tragic story, Daniel starts to understand that following this path may be much more dangerous than he realized. And as people from Carax's life start to turn up dead, Daniel needs to decide how much he is willing to risk, not only to understand the man who wrote The Shadow of the Wind, but also how far he's willing to go to protect it from actually disappearing forever. So, borrowing from his own character's work, this is The Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón. Carlos Ruiz Zafón is a Spanish writer. This book, as well as all of Zafón's books, have been translated into English by Lucia Graves, an author in her own right who was born in England but spent time in Spain. This is a 4-book series, the last of which, The Labyrinth of Spirits, came out in 2016. And unfortunately, 4 years after that, in 2020, Zafón did pass away from colon cancer. I did also just learn that in 2021, there was a new book of stories that are released from this world. So Zafón released stories that kind of take place within the realm of the Cemetery of Forgotten Books. And many of these stories had never been translated into English. And so it was released in English posthumously in 2021. So with two world wars and the Spanish Civil War kind of acts as the backdrop of this story, this is a very gripping novel. It takes readers, honestly, on a truly amazing journey spanning from 1916 all the way to 1966. And it draws together a whole bunch of different elements to it, which I think is what makes it such a popular book and what makes it so engaging to read. It draws in romance, it draws in political intrigue, it draws in mystery, it draws in murder, it has a little bit of magical realism, and it kind of wraps all of this up in a story that honestly just at the core of it stresses the importance and the power that books have and that the written word has. So I have actually mentioned this book on the podcast before. Most recently, when we were talking about books that intimidate us, this was a book that I thought would intimidate me and ended up not intimidating me. So I first picked it up many, many years ago when I was working at Kohl's bookstore, and a colleague of mine recommended it to me, and it was his favorite book. He recommended it to pretty much anybody who would listen to him. He told them to read this book. And I remember picking it up, reading the first page and saying, why? And I put it down. And I did not look at it for months later. And I honestly don't know what made me pick it back up again, but I'm so glad I did. Because once I got past the first page, that was on me. I should have read more. Once I got past the first page, I was kind of welcomed and brought into this magical world of books and mystery and just kind of all of these family histories and like political wartime kind of drama, and it was just, there was so much to this book that really drew me in, and it received one of my very rare 5-star ratings on Goodreads. So I'm very happy that I was able to push past whatever weird block there was and actually finish the book. So yeah, so I would definitely recommend this book if you like historical mysteries, but maybe something that has a bit more to it. It does have a literary feel to it. So I think it is described as a literary mystery or a historical mystery. There is some romance in it, so you do have to not hate romance, I guess. It's not the core of the book, but it does come into the story. And honestly, if you enjoy reading about books, if you enjoy reading about the wonder and the magic that books hold for people, then I think this is a really great, great book for you. Yeah, so I would love to recommend The Shadow of the Wind by Carlos Ruiz Zafón, translated by Lucia Graves.
Thank you, Sadie. You mentioned all the things that I don't care for, but I do love that book. That is a good book. And I think many of us here do too find that. Yeah. So thank you for that. Thank you, everyone, for bringing their book in translations for today. And thank you once again to all the translators that make all these wonderful books available to us and also people from all around the world in all kinds of languages. And as we always say in these special kind of celebration episodes, we always say September is a great month to pick up a work of translation to join in the celebration of National Translation Month, but so is every month of the year. And you know that here we will continue to bring you translator works all throughout the year as often as we can. And looking forward to hearing what translator work you may be reading next. So do share with us. We'd love to hear more about, especially books that we've never heard of in languages that we may not have tackled just yet. So, and then of course, once we learn Esperanto and Dothraki and Elfish, and also I don't remember the name of Elf's language.
Elterkand.
Yeah. So once we learn all of them, we will write our book in those languages, maybe. I don't know. Write a poem. How about that? Short poem. Not your long poem, the short kind. All right. Okay. Well, thank you again for joining us for Keep It Fiction, though. We will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please tell a fellow book lover about it. You can find a list of all the books we discussed in our show notes. Join us next week for another fun book chat. Until then, keep it fictional.